today, the title is The Founding of the School. Already by making the announcement of the School of Isaiah is the understanding that we're going to study the book of Isaiah these days, but not in an attempt to cover the whole book. As you know, that would be impossible in 5 sessions. But we're going to try to trace a line of thought, a line of teaching, and a way, I think, of spirituality that develops from a prophet, a teacher, a preacher called Isaiah, who gathers disciples around himself and really establishes, I think, a school, and that school continues later. And then we're going to look on Friday, ask the question, was Jesus and the disciples of Jesus in the early church in a way a restoration of the school of Isaiah? By school, I mean actually teacher, pupils, and a movement of thought. And that's why at our first session of the staff, we were thinking of different things we could do this week. We can get a sweatshirt, school of Isaiah seal, a school song, mascot, and cheerleaders. An opening prayer from one of the hymns of thanksgiving from the school of Isaiah. Let us pray. Give thanks to Yahweh. Call Yahweh's name aloud. Proclaim Yahweh's deeds to the people. Declare Yahweh's name sublime. Sing of Yahweh, for Yahweh has done marvelous things. Let them be made known to the whole world. Cry out for joy and gladness, you dwellers in Zion, for great in the midst of you is the Holy One of Israel. Open our hearts and open our minds, O God, that hearing the words of this book, we may hear your living word to us. Amen. Once I was teaching a book of the Bible and was well into the second session, and I was still doing introductory material. And I noticed a few people closing their Bibles and giving up on this ever being a Bible study. Someone told me after I thought I came to a Bible study. So I decided instead of giving a long introduction, I'm just going to start with Isaiah 1:1. And jump right in, and then I'm going to sneak the introductory material in. Are you ready? And now, the book of Isaiah, in a way, I would call it the book of the school of Isaiah. And we're going to see that how its primary teacher in the book and the primary words are, of course, the teaching and the preaching of this founding person, Isaiah, but then the whole school, teachers, disciples, in a way put this book together as a kind of a book of their school. So part of it, we're going to talk about some of the other disciples of Isaiah that whose writings are also included. 1 through 11 is the very early preaching of Isaiah. And tomorrow I'm going to show kind of the dating of the different times that Isaiah really had two great teaching times. Between those two times, a rather lengthy time when he was quiet. Probably that was the time he was organizing his students and teaching them, or also spending much time in meditation and prayer. And then a very public time again, and then again Isaiah and the school go into a more silent and a quiet period. But Isaiah 1 and the first chapters of Isaiah would come out of really the first great preaching period, so we think. And anytime we're doing kind of biblical scholarship, we always say this is a good guess. You know, or we say this is the best we can do. It's good to shower that with maybes. You know, when we're guessing about when this was written and how and where or who, or this was a Isaiah or a disciple of Isaiah. You know, we just have, we're tentative, and yet we do the best we can with the minds God has given us, and also looking to the scholarship that God has given to the church. Well, the vision of Isaiah, son of Amoz, concerning Judah and Jerusalem, which he saw in the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. Right away, you know he lived through four kings. Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. Now, in the opening of the preaching of Isaiah here, we think of pictures. And the picture here now is that Yahweh calls Judah on trial. And remember now, when we talk about Judah, we are talking about after Solomon reigned, the great kingdom of David was divided in two. Into the southern kingdom, Judah with its capital in Jerusalem, and the northern kingdom, Israel, with its capital in Samaria. So by the time we get to our dating here of the beginning of Isaiah's career, which was in 740, 742, we're talking about two kingdoms, and he preaches to the southern kingdom with its capital in Jerusalem. And now the kingdom is called before God on trial. And then those who are called as witnesses to the trial are the heavens and the earth. The whole creation, God is saying, look at this people. I want you to examine them with me. And here they are. Listen, you heavens. Earth attend, for Yahweh is speaking. And now Yahweh brings the charges against this people. I reared sons. I raised children. I brought them up. But they have rebelled against me. It's the story of my younger brother. How many times probably my parents said the two older became pastors, and then there's Mark. We reared him. Well, I won't go on. He's a very precious person. But he was the rebel, you know, always in trouble. But this is the picture of a suffering parent. What is the raising of the child? It was the birthing of that child out of Egypt. And leading that child into the wilderness. And there in the wilderness, training that child in the way that child should go. And now Yahweh, the parent, speaks to the heavens and the earth. This child has rebelled. And now I bring the charges. And here's the charge. The ox knows its owner, and the ass its master's crib, but Israel knows nothing, and my people understands nothing. And this magnificent court scene with the entire cosmos there as witnesses, and Yahweh just simply looks at the heavens and the earth and said, the problem with these people is they're not even as smart as a donkey. Now, we untangle this verse. It's very easy if you've grown up on a farm. Now, how many grown up on a farm? Now, I'll ask the question, do the animals ever have any trouble finding the feed box? Were they ever out wandering? They're kind of checking with each other, where is the feed box? My father grew up on a farm in South Dakota and told me when you're plowing away from the feed box, you have to push the animal and then come around and you're going back towards the feed box. You have to restrain the animal. You can feel the horse pulling and pulling. Or he said when we went into town with the wagon and the horses into town, push them along, on the way back to the feed box, restrain them. pull towards the feed box. And Yahweh says, this is the way the animals are. My people don't even know where their feed box is. Wandering all over the place, looking, trying to find food in other places where there is no food. Dear heavens and earth, if only these people could be as smart as an ass. Things would be better. Now, let me bring this up to the New Testament. The New Testament writers, when they had their Hebrew Bible next to them and were working out of the Hebrew Bible, it was a translation. And it was a Greek translation because Greek was their language. And if you go to seminary, you quickly learn the code for that translation. All seminarians, shall we say it together? LXX. You got it. LXX is always the code for the Greek Old Testament or Hebrew Bible. The translation, English translation of the Greek Bible that Luke would have used is this: the ox knows its owner, and the donkey knows the manger of its Lord. But Israel knows nothing, and my people understands nothing. And Raymond Brown, in his massive commentary on the birth narratives, that Luke is very intentional in telling us that Mary and Joseph and shepherds are around a manger where the bread of life is, the food for human beings. And that Luke was thinking of Isaiah 1. But at last, Israel, now in the shepherds and Mary and Joseph, have come back to the true feed box. Look how Eucharistic the symbol is. The very bread of life is in an actual animal feed box. Now, when I read this in Raymond Brown, I says, well, that, you know, it's nice. He sees manger in the Old Testament, manger in the New Testament. Who says they are connected? Now, that's called being a doubter of biblical scholarship. Until once I was in a public library doing some work, got tired of doing my work, and did what you do in a library when you're tired of doing what you're doing. You go to the magazines. I'll admit it. And all the kind of interesting magazines, at least in my perception at that time, were gone. So I picked up Christianity Today. And I found something very interesting. It was a Christmas sermon from the early church preached in Constantinople by Gregory of Nazianzus. Christmas sermon. Church of the Resurrection in Constantinople, and his text was Isaiah 1. And he said, now come as Isaiah bids you to the feed box. And I sat there reading this Christianity Today, and I said, ah, the early church still knew it. They knew what Luke knew, that what Isaiah was accusing Israel had now been reversed at the manger. Now, the question now to ask as we move into the context of Isaiah preaching was, what were all these false feed boxes that these people were wandering around looking for? Looking for food, what were they? Be interesting to go into Luke now. Luke paints a picture of Jesus being the feed box, very counter to the false feed box of the Roman Empire. Caesar Augustus, they had already declared to be the savior of the world and the prince of peace, and the beginning of a new age for humanity. The Roman Empire and all its power and wealth had become the false feed box that Luke now portrays Tom or Roman Empire come to the true feedback. And moving the image back now to the 8th century BC in Judah, what was the false feed boxes that they were running after, that now Isaiah would say, oh, if they would be as smart as the animals and know their true place of food. Now, to do that is to look at a little of the context and the background of the founding of the school of Isaiah. Now, lest you don't know, this is where I'm going to sneak the background material. No, it isn't sneaking anymore since I told you. If you'll look at this chart, and I know some of you can't see it and some are too far away, that it helps me. So if you're too far away, come and look afterwards. But in this period, 783 to 742, in Judah, the southern kingdom, and it had its parallel in Israel, the northern kingdom, 786 to 746, 40 years of continuous reign of two kings. Uzziah in the south and Jeroboam the second in the north. These 40 years were times of unprecedented prosperity. These were what you would call good times. Now, why were they such good times? Well, part of it was luck. I just use the word luck. Here's the Fertile Crescent. You know, this is a very accurate map. Mediterranean Sea, the Dead Sea, Sea of Galilee, Egypt. Then here's the rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates, the great rivers, Babylon, Nineveh, Assyria, and this was called the Fertile Crescent. And the two powers of the Fertile Crescent through hundreds and hundreds and even thousands of years were the peoples of these great fertile valleys of these rivers and the peoples of the great fertile valley of the Nile. And so you have this constant power struggle. You know, and I don't have any word to describe it, so I have a noise. It just kind of... Does that communicate? Okay. During all the... you know, look who's right in the pathway. Judah and Israel. Israel probably a little more because it's on the main path. Judah is more up in the hills. But still, they're both on the pathway of the invading armies as they vie for control of this, what's called the Fertile Crescent. Now, during this time of Uzziah and Jeroboam, just by luck and by the way history works, Egypt was in decline and Assyria was weak. And Babylonia had not really happened yet, you know, as a world power. So it's just one of those accidental kind of times when things are quiet. And you can just go about kind of ordinary exploiting the poor. I was going to say that for later, but it just came in. Ordinary living. And so, without these threats, the two of them, first of all, they expanded their military. Each of them had great military power, so they secured and expanded their borders against the people around them, and were two very kind of at least minor powerful kingdoms during this time. Then, during this time of relative peace, I don't like to use the word peace, I would just say lack of people killing each other during this time. Also, much trading went on across and back and forth across the Fertile Crescent. Because they had established enough power, they could control trade routes, and that meant wealth, money, income. It also meant that there was, during these times of security and prosperity, there was good income and a lot of money. But there's a simple principle that you have so many people in a country, you have so much income and wealth, and if you want to be really, really wealthy, it must mean that some people have to be less wealthy. Have you ever heard of that? In other words, there's only so much stuff for everyone, and if you want to have more and more and more and more and more, somebody has to have less and less and less. And that's what happened in these two countries of Judah and Israel. The rich became more powerful, had control, took over the land of the poor. We even know this from archaeology. More primitive Israel, when there's archaeological digs, there's a more of equality of housing that are dug up from those earlier times. And now during these times of kings, the massive homes of the rich, and then the poor living in these huts or crowded areas on the edge. And they had lost their land, and now the rich had added field to field to field. And then the old books and the covenant writings had a way that if you were wronged, you could go to the elders who sat in the gates of the cities, and you could find justice there in the gates. So the poor went to the gates and met the elders who had been bribed and paid off by the rich. So there was no place to go. And Isaiah uses the image of the poor just being stomped or ground into the dirt. These were the good times if you were rich. And for the rich, it was wonderful, wonderful, wonderful times. It would be the times later you would look back and say, ah, those good old days when we had all the wealth, prosperity, and we're piling it up, and there were no wars going on, and we were protected, and our borders were secure. We had defense that was so adequate, and no one could touch us. The good old days. Then, the second characteristic was, our wealth not only depends upon trading, but it depends upon the continuation of good crops. Our ancient religion is a religion of worshiping Yahweh. How do we know that Yahweh will promise us good crops? Just in case, maybe we better try what was called ancient crop insurance policies, which made a lot of sense in that day. You know, just in case Yahweh was a little weak, we better try the fertility gods and goddesses. Just in case. Just in case they might have some power over fertility, which the peoples around us have taught us that they do, we better worship them. And to a Yahwist, are you acquainted with the word Yahwist? Those would be the people in ancient Israel and Judah who were true to the worship of the God of Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Jacob, and the four bears, Yahweh. So the Yahwists were the faithful ones. And to the Yahwists, this was harlotry, or going off to other lovers. It wasn't just doing the wrong thing, but it was leaving the true lover and going off to other lovers. The other was, at the same time when they went to the temple in Jerusalem, they did everything right according to the Yahwist religion. They followed every liturgical rubric to perfection, because they believed if they did that right, then God would be pleased with them and they would prosper. So they had everything going for them. Secure borders, trading that brought wealth, exploiting the poor that brought more wealth to some people, plus the fertility religions to guarantee good crops, and the perfect ritual in the temple that would guarantee that Yahweh God would always protect us and keep things going well. Now, can anybody guess anything in the context that would be called false mangers or false places of food where there is no food? Or is that just too obvious of a question? What were they running after instead of running to the true feed box? Just listen. Say again.
If I remember Isaiah, they were relying on political security. They're putting their confidence, their peace of mind, in the fact that borders were secure.
Yeah. Our borders are secure because we have a marvelous military machine. And they did. So does that, you know, maybe that's one of the false.
Didn't alliances also play a role?
Yeah, we're going to look at that. We'll look at that tomorrow. Did I hear one?
I just said security, basically. Yeah, prosperity, security.
Prosperity and security. And also the what I call the false feed box of wealth and accumulation that was really happening. You know, they were really piling it up. And so
having the poor around you in the false sense that they were better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you had someone to be better than. Mm-hmm. Hadn't thought of that.
And worship, too. They were making themselves feel comfortable, that they were secure because it was doing the ritual.
Yeah, doing the ritual and doing it right. Now, why I'm going to make a faith statement now. A faith statement means you kind of think very tentatively that you know what God was thinking. But God looked at this situation, Yahweh looked at this situation and said, it is about ready to fall apart. I think it's time for a preacher. Now I'll show how it was about ready to fall apart. Assyria is weak, but in the year 745, Tiglath-Pileser III, you've all heard of him, Tiglath-Pileser III began to restore the Assyria to glory. I don't know about that statement, if Assyria had that much of a former glory. But I read that all the way back to the 13th century BCE, the people of Nineveh and the area of Assyria had dreamed of the day when they would control the Fertile Crescent. And now the time is right, the leadership is right, and Tiglath-Pileser gathers an army and has begun the conquest. And by the time Isaiah is called, Tiglath-Pileser has conquered Arpad, which is the capital of the northern province of Syria. Really two provinces away from the northern kingdom of Israel. Tiglath-Pileser is on the way. And everybody is just sitting around thinking that because they're doing the worship right and everything, that nothing can happen to us. But it's times of peace and times of prosperity that are almost over because there's rumbling in the east. Now, I have a question here now to help us to think of Isaiah in our context, and always with the realization it can't be completely in our context, times are always different, but there are also similarities. Would anybody here, I'll just say what my prejudice and perception is, and see, would anybody agree or disagree with me that we in the Western, Northern, First World have lived in a time of unprecedented prosperity? And is it a possibility that we kind of live at an Isaiah type of time? You know, is there rumblings in the world that it's soon over? And by soon, it could be 1 year, 5 years, 10 or 50 years. But will it be over? And you know, I guess I would ask the question, am I reading too much of our situation into that, or are there similarities, and what would be the signs that maybe this time is over? Anybody?
If you look at the history of Western civilization, any of the great empires, dating back as far back as there, there have been those periods of economic, military, prosperity, greatness, and in fact, if you adopt a cyclical view of history, then we certainly are in that same sort of a pattern of internal chaos, division, and that down cycle.
Any other
perceptions? I think nationally, too, you know, our attitude is one of we're doing everything right. We vocal or verbalize this religion that we have, you know. So I think we're setting ourselves up. We put too much emphasis or place too much security in the fact that we're doing everything we think right. It's kind of a not right.
Well, it's a sad fact that anytime you have peace, you have diversion of people going their own separate ways. The only time that we really work together is when we're at war.
Yeah.
So if we're at peace now, it's natural.
We've seen that there are more millionaires and trillionaires than there's ever been before, but we're more poor too. The piling up is very evident.
And there are definitely the rumblings from the third world.
Yeah, the aspirations of the poor of the world that in a way won't be stopped.
And the false beauty that the weapons that we're building are really protected. Our technology will always save us. Wonderful side of technology.
We have a few minutes. Just if you want to review now these themes of Isaiah's preaching. First, a cry against injustice as covenant breaking. Two, that destruction will come, but a remnant will survive. Three, external cult or playing church is futile to protect you. Do you know what I mean, playing church? Okay. Then, was that three? And four is the glorious future. I said five, but I got two of them under two. The remnant that will survive, that would be one to make it five. Are you mixed up now? Okay.
Can you tell me what year you think that what I call Promise 4 or God's Promises in Isaiah were written? When you talk of the covenant promises of God, and that the one in Isaiah to be an important promise that God gives.
Oh, I don't know.
But if it was around 740 BC, when did you start writing Isaiah? When was it?
Well, it was written down later by disciples, probably. But the context of the preaching of this of these first chapters seems to be the early career of Isaiah, which would be after his call in 742, the year that King Uzziah died. Of lay people helping out the impoverished. I don't know. I would guess there was a group of faithful Yahwists, you know, who believed in keeping the covenant, you know, that must have done what they could to help the poor that were in such a desperate situation. But I don't know. That's just my guess.
You're saying, Dan, that the faithful Yahwists were independent of Isaiah's word, or?
No, I would say Isaiah was one of the. Yahwist is a word that's all the time when people were running after other gods. They were the minority, often the minority of people that chose to remain faithful to the covenant. Maybe the call of Isaiah maybe happened when he was doing his liturgical duties. That could even happen to you. At the altar. I may imagine you ho hum another day of going through this ritual, and all of a sudden, zang! Or if it were in the Sunday comic strip, it would be what? Varoom?
Now and showing the caring of somebody in this era.
I just thought I had Spider-Man down. Oh, I have to deal with that.
Doing for the cause of good.
Well, I'll watch it when I go. I was going to have assignments. And I forgot. Okay. Read chapter 11, 1 through 11, which is the first preaching period, and then chapter 28 through 32. Or use this week to read the whole book. And tomorrow I'll kind of give you a reading chart, which we might think different periods of Isaiah, but the two really main preaching periods of the original founder of the school, 1 through 11, and then chapter 28 through 32.
We don't get on the
boat. Oh yeah, there'll be a final. Also think of school songs, school cheers.